Join longtime local and social butterfly Michelle Dragony as she flits up and down the coastside on her intrepid cruiser Flame, chatting with coastal characters at every turn.
So here we are again today, and I met Richard Wilson yesterday outside More for Less, and he was putting up a yard sign, and I thought to myself, who is this Richard Wilson? And here he is to do a little podcast with us, and he's going to tell us who he is and why he wants to run for the judge of San Mateo County. So Richard, who are you? How'd you get here?
I'm Rick Wilson, a candidate for judge of the Superior Court in San Mateo County. I've lived in San Mateo County for over 30 years with my wife, Marie. We have four children. We raised our children here, put them through the schools here. They're out of the house now. And
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. We're still recovering in some ways. Fortunately, our sons went through college and grad school, and that's what we're recovering from. But they're doing great. My wife is also an attorney, and she and I went different career paths. I started out in the litigation field early on in my career, and she has always gone the corporate attorney route, mm-hmm. and she works in technology companies on the peninsula. We've always lived and worked together in that dual career way, but having as a priority raising our children here on mm-hmm. the peninsula. I'm now at this point in my life where I completed my career at the University of California. I can give more background into that employment history, but decided that as a next step, and what I determined was the thing that I most wanted to do to conclude my career in public mm-hmm. service, was to run for Superior Court Judge, to be a Superior Court Judge, and I think I'd be very good at it.
Well, it's going to take a lot of time, right?
It's pretty much day and night for me right now. You mean running for judge?
Both. Yes. I mean, I've been interviewing candidates for a while, and it's a little overwhelming what you guys have to go through. How are you doing with that?
I'm doing fine. And my wife is working during the day, and then she comes home at night, and she's burning the candle on both ends, mm-hmm. doing this with me.
Right.
But she's a real strong partner in this, and mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate to have that. And then she's really very good at outreach with people, mm-hmm. and she fields a lot of the phone calls and emails and connections that we are right. making with people. Surprisingly enjoyable parts about mm-hmm. this is that you go through mm-hmm. your whole career, and unless you're just that kind of person like Tony Robbins or something, you're not out there always meeting
right.
people and presenting
yeah.
yourself and doing things like that, whereas I've had to get out of my shell a little bit and
sure.
meet people, talk
mm-hmm.
to people, and people have been responding, and I found that to be just really a meaningful experience.
Oh,
and
that's
people
nice.
Around us in San
right.
Mateo County. Another thing I never really thought about too much is how big San Mateo County is, really.
It's huge.
Population, geography,
yeah.
and I've always thought of San Mateo County as a diverse community, but you mm-hmm. tend to think of that in terms of demographics and mm-hmm. You know, people's backgrounds. But it's also diverse with very rural, very high-tech, in between.
Farm fishing to high-tech,
yeah.
yeah.
And
yeah.
this has been an opportunity where you really have to do a mapping of the county
mm-hmm.
and of the people and of the different activities and get out and about. And that's
mm-hmm.
also been a really meaningful part of it for me. So
mm-hmm.
even though it's a lot of work, it's also been very rewarding
nice.
In that way. And we're still at it because the election isn't until June 5. After June 5, we'll probably
that's
drop
right.
and, you know,
yeah, I mean,
sleep for a couple of days. But so far, it's been very good.
Nice. Well, you have a lot of passion for it. So why do you want to run? Because it takes a lot of passion and a lot of energy, and you get the energy from your passion. So what's the passion that's driving this?
That question is an interesting one, because after I completed a career sort of overseeing and managing litigation for the University of California, and just so that's clear,
mm-hmm.
I'm coming off of a number of years working for the system-wide headquarters of the University of California.
Mm.
At the office of the president in Oakland, there's the system-wide functions,
mm-hmm.
including a system-wide legal office. The university is a large system with campuses
mm.
all over the state, and you
mm-hmm.
have many kinds of claims and litigation that arise out
imagine.
Of operations
mm-hmm.
of a big system like that. And so you have to have a way of organizing that and
yeah,
managing that
right.
and then having people that oversee that
mm-hmm.
and oversee the attorneys that do the direct representation, making the decisions on resolutions of cases.
Mm-hmm.
whether to take cases to trial, monitoring them through trial, post-trial, and the settlements, and the, you know, through mediation or settlement conference, or whatever. So I was involved in all of that for a large program for the university as the senior counsel oversees that. That was a very busy job. And I'm just coming off of that. But when I decided to step back from that and the intensity of that, I'm still too young, too energetic to stop. And I've got a big kind of skill set and certain things that I feel I'm good at from that experience. So I thought about what's the one thing that I would most like to do that I haven't done in my career that I think would be the most rewarding, the most meaningful, and that I would be good at, that I could take my background and experience and apply it effectively. Plus, there's a lot of just personality characteristics, temperament, demeanor, the things that go into making a good judge. And from feedback from people who know me and say, well, you make a good judge. And that's what's driving me. And I think that once I get on the bench and join the court, I would be able to add a lot of value with the kind of background that I have.
Yeah, right. Well, I think just about everybody in the world would like to be a judge, but I think there's only very few people who have the skill set. So go a little bit further. Patience, calm, what else? What are the type of personality traits that you have that would make a good judge? Because I don't really know. I mean, I've never been a judge. Not even sure. What does a judge do? I mean, I know you sit there, but tell me, what is a day in a judge's life?
There's a few elements in the question that you just asked, so let me just take a crack at it, and if I miss some, let me know. But what does it take? I mean, it does take to be a good judge. I mean, to be a judge that that people respect or appreciate is doing a good job, if you want to put it that way. I think you do have to have those personality and behavioral characteristics. You have to have a certain amount of patience. You have to have understanding and compassion, the ability to look at both sides of an issue. One of the qualities that I put in my materials is that fairness, being fair and equitable to everybody. We live in a diverse and pluralistic community, and we all come from different backgrounds with different perspectives and biases. Biases isn't necessarily a bad word. Everybody has certain biases. You need to recognize where those lie and then be able to apply your best judgment and understanding after studying the facts and issues and be fair and equitable. Right. And I use both of those words, fair and equitable. They sound like they're almost synonyms, but they're a little bit different. Fair is fair, based on the facts, giving people a fair shake, you know, calling the shots the way you think is indicated and best by the evidence, circumstances, that you understand them. However you want to define fair, but I think people have a general understanding of that. Equitable is kind of like that, but it also means you should treat people the same. There's, you know, there's an equality and an equity. So for example, if you have one person coming in before you who's I don't know, make up a situation. They've they've broken and entered into a building and, and stolen something. And you, after all the circumstances and talking to the defender and to the prosecutor or whatever, you decide, you know, you're going to give that person X. And let me just say, I don't come from a criminal background. The reason I'm using that example is I've been getting tutored and up the learning curve on the criminal side of it, because that's a big part of the caseload and so on. Eventually, you end up having to do some criminal things. But for the explanation of equitable, then let's say a month later, you're dealing with a similar set of characters and a similar, roughly similar offense, and you give a materially different decision or disposition on that. And why are those two situations different? Are you being equitable? Also equitable is how you divide up things, how you decide things should be divided up based on the rights and you know, things that are presented to you. But I feel like that's something that I have in my my basic character, is being fair and equitable toward people. And some of that has to do with diversity too, and you have to be someone who's very open and non-discriminatory in terms of what does a judge do and the qualities that people want in a judge. Sort of classically, people think of the male-female thing, and you don't want judges to be favoring males or condescending to women. Some judges are. You don't want judges to be thinking that African-American defendants are more risk of something than someone else in similar circumstances. You have to be very careful about that. I happen to have a black or African-American son. I also have a son-in-law who's Hispanic, and he's half Hispanic and half American Indian. His mom is fully blooded American Indian. So through my African American son and my Hispanic son-in-law, you know, I've tapped into as a family and also raising our kids with that, these different communities, in addition to being just interested in these different communities anyway, because our family, all through our years together raising up, we've traveled quite a bit and we really like just the diversity of life. So that's another quality I think I can apply and bring to bear.
Well, it's certainly an important quality in this day and age. I know implicit bias training is becoming more common in the police academies and things like that, but implicit bias is something that everybody has. You're raised with it. Your parents give it to you pretty much, however you're raised. But I think it is a matter of awareness. We all have to just be aware and conscious of what we're doing. And I think, as you said, compassion drives that. So that's
And there's a balance, compassion and understanding and justice. And you have to be able to balance those ideas and those duties, really.
Yes.
And dispense appropriate justice, but under the circumstances and with due consideration to those elements that you might think contribute to what occurred, and to having some compassion for those circumstances. And I think I understand that. I think I have internalized that through my years. And I was that way when I oversaw and managed litigation, and also when I directly litigated when I was with the law firm. That's part of my background I didn't mention. I was a partner in a litigation law firm before I went to the university, and I went to another public entity before the university. The Judicial Council of California Administrative Office of the Courts, which is the governing body of the California court system. So I worked in the courts and for the courts.
Cool. Interesting.
Also a litigation management and oversight role. And got into courts all over the state and so on. But I also directly litigated when I was a partner in the litigation law firm, including in San Mateo County. But some of those qualities I felt developed dealing with actual cases, in litigating cases, but then also when I was working in my public employment for the public entities. You really, to properly defend or represent your client, you need to carefully understand and assess both sides of the issues. And if you're, I think, an attorney of integrity and high ethical standards, your goal isn't to necessarily just, by whatever means necessary, give your opponent the poorest deal and give your client the best deal. People will come to respect you on both sides of the bar if you have more of an attitude of trying to understand both sides and reach the resolution and compromise that is, you know, you still have the duty to meet the needs of your client, represent your client, but but you get better outcomes by behaving in sort of the way I'm alluding to than the hardscrabble, mad dog, aggressive litigation styles. And so I think as a judge, with all of that background and with that temperament and attitude through all of these years in my public and private employment, I think I have a very centered and good sense of what a judge should be like. And again, that relates to temperament, demeanor, and how one behaves oneself.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the nuance of the words. I'm as an English teacher, I enjoy the nuance of the thought that this, it's a difficult job, and you are balancing those things all the time. So thank you for illustrating that. How do judges usually become judges? Do they get elected, or are they appointed, or what? Do they come up through litigation? Do they have the broad background that you do? What's the pattern there? And do you know the judges that are in San Mateo because you've been litigating here for a while?
The first part of that question, how do judges become judges, that touches on an issue that I've raised and am discussing in my campaign. And I've written a paper on it, which I've distributed to a lot of the attorneys and have
and it's on your website.
Yeah, and that's it's just what's called a working paper, because it was something that I wanted to have as a concept piece that I work with and developed to discuss that very issue. How do people become appointed or elected to judicial office at the superior court level, which is the county level? And most, by far most, become judge by being appointed.
Who appoints them? Supervisors?
Ultimately, it's a governor, a gubernatorial appointment. But there's a process of application, and then there's a panel of people that review applicants, and then there's input from the local level, from people that are active in the court locally, and then they have a list of people that they would submit to the governor. And then the governor's office, he has an assistant or person who, or people who review those, and then mm-hmm. they make recommendations. Mm-hmm. So, but there's a lot of factors that go into that. And one of the issues that I'm raising here is that the California Constitution provides for 6-year terms mm-hmm. for Superior Court judges, with re-election required after 6 years, subject to re-election, mm-hmm. which is what we call, not to be too technical, mm-hmm. a retention election. Be mm-hmm. retained and serve right. another 6 years. Mm-hmm. So in that constitutional design, there's this idea that judges are at least subject to election. The way that it's evolved and developed over time, mm-hmm. judges retire or resign to do something else or die while in office during their term. And when that occurs, then that vacancy is filled by appointment. And then that judge who's appointed, when that term comes up, then has to file to continue and be at least theoretically subject to election. Mm. But if nobody opposes,
then there's no election.
There's no election. Mm. They don't appear on the ballot. And nobody knows about them, hears about them.
Right.
So most people can't even name a single judge on the San Mateo County Superior Court unless they've had some experience
right.
using the court, if you will. And so what I'm saying, which is also described in this working paper I put together, and I did in that, just a 3-page document mm-hmm. with
sure,
bullet
I read
points,
it.
So
mm-hmm.
it's easy mm-hmm. to read.
It is.
Just for understanding, mm-hmm. is that there's pros, arguments in favor of why mm-hmm. that's the overall best interest, that we have a perpetual non-opposed incumbency. And there's arguments that say, no, it's healthier for the system if, at least in some circumstances, sometimes you actually have a challenge.
Yes.
And you have an opposing candidate. Mm-hmm. I came down kind of in the middle because I'm not saying that most of the judges are not performing. I think by far mm-hmm. most judges are well-motivated, well-qualified, performing up to standards mm-hmm. or exceeding standards, mm-hmm. and well-respected. And for those, I think that the system of unopposed incumbency probably works okay. Although what gets lost in that, which I don't think there's a good solution for, mm-hmm. is the public.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the mm-hmm. electorate. Because mm-hmm. with that chronic, perpetual, unopposed mm-hmm. incumbency,
sure.
the voters or the public in the community get no information. Mm-hmm. And it's almost impossible for you, even me as a lawyer, to get much information
right. uh-huh.
on a judge unless you really know how to research their cases and even their backgrounds. You know, you have to do a lot
nice
of digging.
It'd be nice just to know
that.
What their educational background was, you know, like I mean, that's why I wanted to do the podcast with you. I mean, what who are you?
And you can kind of find that educational background stuff because the court will.
But you want personality too.
Yeah, the court will post a profile of the judges. Some of the profiles are years old.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
and
right.
you
yeah.
don't learn that much except maybe where they went to school, maybe,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
when they early on when they were on the bench. There's profiles published by what we call reporting services mm-hmm. that you subscribe to, but those are mm-hmm. very expensive subscriptions.
Yeah,
and your average
sure.
people can't get them. So it's just the bottom line is it's very difficult for most people, if they're interested,
yes.
to learn much. But there isn't really a vehicle for the public or voters to get information that's disseminated.
Yeah, and you guys don't go to forums or anything like that.
There isn't really any...
The sheriffs are at least doing forums.
Yeah, there
forums,
really isn't
but
much
it,
opportunity for that, for especially for a judicial yeah. election. And
right.
one reason is they're so uncommon. There just isn't really
yeah.
a model for how to mm-hmm. handle that. Mm-hmm. And so my basic tenet is that once in a while, there are circumstances where it's healthy mm-hmm. for the court and it's healthy for the community mm-hmm. to identify that a challenge or a contest is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who does that? Well, it's the candidate that decides to step up and stick his head up
right.
and make the challenge.
Right, which Mark Melville is doing against Sheriff Bolanos.
And
it's the same exact story. You know, they haven't had an election for 25 years. Because there's been a handing down of appointments, but which is not unusual for sheriff appointments. But you're every once in a while, an election's not a bad idea. And as a teacher, if you have your population and they get used to not having elections for these positions, then they don't realize that there are supposed to be elections for these positions, and so they don't know that they're being not included in the conversation at all.
And it also, what you just described relates to a question of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
In that if you are in an office because they didn't give Superior Court judges lifetime appointments. Mm-hmm. If you're in an office and you pretty much know that you're not going to be opposed. And this year, there were 10 offices up, terms were mm-hmm. up for re-election. If I hadn't stepped up, all 10 would have gone through, never right. appeared on the ballot, nobody would even know about it. I stepped up because I thought it was appropriate to do so. And so we've got this one. And so the issue of accountability, as I also argue in my materials, is that it is at least healthy for judges to know that they have the possibility of challenge.
Oh, I agree. Keeps you honest.
Bar.
Yes, absolutely.
And if you never see that, yeah. you go cycle after cycle. Now, where the, you do have elections, the ones that people who think about it might remember is not a challenge to an incumbent who's filing for another term, but an open seat election where someone decides to retire. Mm-hmm. when their term is expiring mm-hmm. or leave to go be a mediator or something, mm-hmm. then that creates an open seat at that election where you're not running with an incumbent involved. Mm-hmm. Then attorneys who are qualified can apply to run for that open seat. People call that a contested judicial election right. too, but it's not a contested retention election
right.
against an incumbent, which
yeah.
is rare, which is why in my materials I say mine is a rare contested election.
Right.
And there's reasons for that too. Like I said, by far most of the judges are probably performing. But I think any court of significant size, like ours has, well, let's just say we've got, for purpose of argument, 30 judicial officers. Mm-hmm. I use the image of the bell-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. You have people who are in the center of the bell-shaped curve who are performing within mm-hmm. standards, performing fine. You've got some on the right, called the right tail of the bell-shaped mm-hmm. curve, just like your gunner students in school mm-hmm. when you mm-hmm. were a teacher. Those are the real mm-hmm. Outstanding performers mm-hmm. everybody recognizes as such mm-hmm. but then you've got some that are on the left tail mm-hmm. for whatever reason, not necessarily mm-hmm. some, even maybe it's one mm-hmm. and in those instances, if a member of the bar or a group of members of the bar feel like it might be time mm-hmm. for that person to be replaced or to move on, it's perfectly valid, perfectly legitimate for someone in that circumstance to decide to step up and say, I'm going to challenge.
Gotcha.
That's my point.
Yes.
And in that circumstance, if they feel that that's valid, that that is kind of describes the mm-hmm. performance and behavior of that incumbent judge mm-hmm. for whatever the reasons are, but they have to be good and valid reasons, I would say.
Right.
Which I feel I have. Mm-hmm. Then that challenge should not be treated as if it's an apostasy.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Like it's
like how rude.
It's an interloper.
Right.
Or you're so suspect because you're stepping up to challenge. And I'm not saying many people do that, but there tends to be in the institutionalized part of it, the mm-hmm. incumbent, the other judges and so on, when a sure. challenge occurs, which doesn't happen very often, tends to be a reflexive reaction. We support our fellow mm-hmm. judge. And
yeah. Well, people don't like change. But so here's an interesting question. Is there any kind of as judges get older, we're all have the potential for maybe getting dementia or, Alzheimer's and these types of things, or not being physically really able to do the proper due diligence. Is there any kind of in the judge culture, sort of like a self-policing kind of thing where, you might back channel the guy and say, hey, I know you're having some problems. Does that ever happen? If it does happen, is it effective, or is this why we have elections?
That's a very good question, and I think an insightful question in terms of just how things work in a system or in mm-hmm. an institution. I would say the answer to that is there's an informal mechanism and there's a formal.
Okay.
The formal is ultimately the Commission on Judicial Performance, the CJP, and you can look up on their website and see different situations that they get involved in. And if there's really an issue with mental or physical capacity, mm-hmm. ability to adequately and maybe consistently perform your duties up to standards or the way that you should, mm-hmm. that can be brought to the attention of the office in San Francisco, the Commission on Judicial Performance, and then they probably, if it's a credible mm-hmm. reference, they will investigate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that happens very often, but I don't really have any data on that. Right. The other would be informal, where your co-judicial officers would maybe talk with you, like if a term is coming up, and some mm-hmm. judges stay on quite long, they get to be very senior.
Yes.
And you can't say that's good or bad or indifferent. There are instances where there sure. can be faltering on that. And then I think the informal is that your presiding judge, your supervising judges and so on, maybe your colleagues who know you might talk to you and say, well, are you right. planning to continue? You know, do you maybe explore those issues, and maybe just with right. Some counseling and persuasion, that person could be persuaded to retire.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm sure that happens. I just don't know
how often
that happens.
So, Rick, does that have any reason why you want to run?
Let me put it this way. In deciding to run, I had to make a couple of decisions. Of course, the ultimate goal was to become a Superior Court judge. Once I make that judgment determination and I've got the drive for it, mm-hmm. then how to go about that? What does that mean? And then which office am I going to seek? Because you have to identify, of the 10 that were up for re-election, you have to identify a particular office, meaning a particular incumbent that you are
okay.
challenging.
Ah,
you can't
okay.
just say, I'm seeking office and I'm taking on all 10 of you.
Oh.
You have to choose an office. So the office I'm seeking is actually called office number 2,
okay.
with the incumbent being Gerald Buchwald.
Okay.
In making that decision, I had to be very careful. I did my research.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to people. I observed mm-hmm. not just the one office, but others.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I made a very reasoned and careful and considered choice based on all of my experience and from everything that I was hearing
mm-hmm.
and getting reports about from others. So I feel I have good reasons
mm-hmm.
why. And I feel that that decision that I made and my wife with me made when we decided to do this
mm-hmm.
has been validated over and over and over again, because once we filed,
mm-hmm.
we have been getting contacted by attorneys, by parties in lawsuits, people who have had experiences with that courtroom
mm-hmm.
and with that judge, and basically reinforcing
mm-hmm.
the conclusion that we came to in deciding that this was the appropriate challenge to make. And so when I say it's time for change in my materials and including my ads, it's time for a positive change,
mm-hmm.
Not only in the systemic issues I was just talking about and stepping up in the context of this perpetuation of incumbency, but also it's time for change in this particular judicial office,
right.
office number two. That's my answer.
Thank you, Rick. Well, you got the passion for it. You got the energy for it. It looks like you got support for it, too. You're not tired yet, right? You got a month to go.
Just from the campaigning, but I've got enough to make the home stretch here, which
nice.
We're approaching with
yes.
the mail ballots. That's a first-time implementation of the Voter Choice Act.
Right, we'll get this podcast out tonight.
Okay.
And that way you can share it with your constituents. So that they
Thank
can
you.
Share it with their constituents, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I appreciate doing this and working with you. It's been a very pleasant experience.
Well, thank you, Rick. I've enjoyed you coming in. It was really fun.
Thank you.